Anti-War Radio on Chaos 92.7 FM in Austin, Texas. Earlier this week, Vice Admiral Jack Shanahan, Dr. Lawrence Korb, the former Assistant Secretary of Defense, and Lieutenant General Robert G. Gard, Jr., U.S. Army retired chairman of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, wrote a letter to the House of Representatives protesting concurrent resolution, House Concurrent Resolution 362, which I believe is currently in committee and is expected to pass. And this is a resolution condemning Iran, mandating new sanctions and further measures. And this is, of course, of the utmost importance and most immediate importance, our relationship with Iran. While it seems like we're opening negotiations and sending State Department functionaries to meet with the Iranians in Switzerland this weekend, this coming weekend, we have our Congress who are rattling their sabers quite loudly. I'm pleased to welcome to the show Lieutenant General Robert Gard. He is the chairman of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, former president of the National Defense University, and co-author of this letter. Welcome to the show, sir.
Happy to participate.
Well, I'm very happy to have you here. And I guess let's get right to this letter you wrote to the House of Representatives. The three of you, Vice Admiral Jack Shanahan, retired, Lawrence Korb, former Assistant Secretary of Defense, and yourself, Chairman of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. What are your objections to this resolution coming through the House of Representatives and the companion bill in the Senate right now?
Well, even though a concurrent resolution is not binding, nevertheless, it sends a very, very threatening message. If it passes as it is currently worded, it states, among other things, that we would impose stringent inspection requirements on all persons, vehicles, ships, planes, trains, and cargo entering or departing Iran.
My goodness.
Now, in order to achieve that, you in effect would have to set up a blockade. Now, the resolution also says nothing in this resolution should be interpreted as authorizing the use of force. But how in the world are you going to impose stringent inspections in all of those venues without using force?
Well, which congressman wrote this thing? Do we know?
Gosh.
Maybe we could ask him.
Congressman, I believe, named Anderson, has been the most ardent advocate and has written memos to his colleagues saying, it's all being misinterpreted. It says we're not going to use any force. Well, if we're not, we ought to take out the imposition of stringent inspections.
And now, under what authority, is there something in international law that would say to enforce a UN resolution about uranium enrichment or something that America has the authority to level a blockade against Iran like that?
I certainly wouldn't interpret it that way. I'm not an international lawyer, but I think that would be a whale of a stretch.
Well, now, so if we follow this thing to its conclusion, and you say blockade, what exactly would that entail? We're talking about our entire Navy surrounding their country and intercepting planes, forcing them to land, to be searched, and just the worst case scenario?
Well, if I recall, the congressman says, oh, we check all this stuff at the source before it comes in. But my goodness, how are you going to check the contents of every airplane that will take off from any country that might have Tehran as its destination? This seems to me to go well beyond the naval blockade.
Wow. So now this is, and it's also beyond sanctions, and I don't know exactly how different sanctions on different countries are enforced, I guess mostly through financial means and such, but this is, I believe, unless the rules have changed, a blockade like this describes is officially an act of war, is it not?
That's my understanding. Yes, it is.
And now, as you said, this is just a concurrent resolution. It has no binding force. And so maybe are we too worried about something that is not really going to dictate the president's policy anyway? Because it is his policy, not Congress's, after all.
Well, but if you get the body that represents the American people sending this kind of signal to Iran, when we now have the slightest opening of the door that the United States might actually be willing to engage in a dialogue with Iran. So you slap out this resolution. What does that tell the government of Iran? It reinforces all of the threats that we've made over the years to change the regime in Iran.
Right, sort of at the same time we're taking a step forward, we're taking a step and a half at least backwards, it seems like.
Yeah, well, it's just that we all understand that members of the Congress can, for political reasons that perhaps we all understand, take certain stands that really don't have any mandatory effect. But while we might understand that, I think the nation against whom we are making these kinds of resolutions might read it very differently. Certainly we'll see it if it passes as overwhelming hostility toward their country. And that's counterproductive. This administration has failed to take overtures that have been made to it by Iranian authorities over and over again to engage in dialogue to resolve our differences. This suggests we have no desire to do so. At least our legislative body does not.
Well, now, I don't know. You have the word Lieutenant General retired in front of your name, and yet you sound like such a peacenik. Is it because the policy is just that bad, or because you've really changed from the warrior you used to be?
No, I'm not opposed to all uses of force in the national interest. I think in this particular case, this kind of imposition of force would be highly counterproductive, as indeed would a military attack on Iran because of the consequences. Iran has let us know in no uncertain terms what its reaction would be. And let me tell you, if we think that the Iranians have worked against our interests in Iraq, just go bomb Iran and watch what happens.
Well, what do you think will happen in Iraq if we bomb Iran?
Well, the first thing they can do it very easily. There's a long supply line from Kuwait to Baghdad. Thousands of trucks go up that route every day. It would be no problem whatever to totally block the resupply of American troops. This leaves aside attacks against them, against our combat troops, which surely would occur in that event. The Iranians have told us that in the event of such an attack, they will launch barrages of missiles at U.S. bases, at sources of oil. They will block the Straits of Hormuz. They will give free passage to terrorists. We're highly vulnerable in that area. We got our hands full right now. We've got a fight on our hands in Afghanistan that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff admits is undermanned. He wants more troops but doesn't have any. And people who are advocating this sort of military action against Iraq are inviting big trouble.
Now, in terms of the occupation of Afghanistan, do you think that's a good idea, giving them more troops? Is that any more justified or any more workable of an occupation than the one in Iraq, for example?
It's different in some respects, but after all, the Taliban that protected al-Qaeda and refused to turn it over has been rejuvenated. Our own intelligence tells us that al-Qaeda has reconstituted its central command, is fully capable now of planning attacks against the homeland. That's where the source of our problem is.
But they're in Pakistan.
Pardon me?
but they're in Pakistan.
They're in Pakistan, but they're also in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Well, in order to solve the problem, we have to invade Pakistan, right?
Well, that of course, is a very ticklish situation.
Yeah, it seems more like a Vietnam thing, where we can't go after them, but we can sit here and try to hold them off forever.
You know, there is that similarity. There's no doubt. I can recall so well in Vietnam from a helicopter looking across the border into Cambodia. And you could see the supplies stacked up, and we couldn't go after them. There's no question that presents real problems, but it isn't something we can ignore. That is the heart of the potential terrorist attacks against the United States. We invaded Iraq as a war of choice against a regime that presented no immediate threat to this country, that had no connection to 9/11. We didn't finish the job in Afghanistan. We had Osama bin Laden and 1,000 of his followers bottled up in Tora Bora. And our operative, the chief operator on the ground, asked for 800 American Rangers to block the exits to Tora Bora, and was turned down because we were already turning our attention to invading Iraq.
Well, and on the Taliban, on getting a regime change and setting up a puppet government rather than fighting the actual people responsible for attacking us.
Well, we didn't finish the job. We relied on the Northern Alliance, the warlords, to block the exits from Tora Bora. Reportedly, Osama bought one of them off for $1.5 million, and he and his cohorts were escorted into Waziristan. I mean, it's just pathetic how we diverted our attention in order to satisfy the pipe dream of people who had been advocating regime change in Iraq so that they could remake the Middle East since the late 1990s.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, to tie this back into Iran, you know, the war party would like us to believe that there's this danger from Islam and this clash of civilizations and that we're not supposed to try to differentiate between this group or that. But the Iranians were on our side against the Taliban, and they've been on our side in Iraq, or at least we've been on their side in Iraq since the election of January 2005. So, well, can't we all just get along? Do we even need to have any sort of conflict? Why not just give the Ayatollah a big hug and be friends at this point? We know they're not making nuclear weapons in the presence of IAEA inspectors.
Well, we have had countless opportunities to engage in a comprehensive dialogue with the Iranians. I mean, just this year, Khamenei in January said, and I quote, "We never said that these relations, that is with the U.S., will be suspended indefinitely. I would be the first to approve this with the United States the day it is of benefit to the nation." In May, there was an extensive memorandum written to the Secretary General of the United Nations by the foreign minister of Iran, proposing a package for constructive negotiations that was very comprehensive. And he said, as recently as this month, "I said I would be willing to consider dialogue on our nuclear program." Even Ahmadinejad, who is a bit of a loose cannon, said on the 14th of this month that he would welcome direct talks with the U.S. if both parties were on an equal footing. He said that on state television. But this administration has insisted that it will not engage in discussions with Iran unless it first suspends enrichment of uranium. And as the Iranian ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency has pointed out, the Iranians did suspend in Richmond for 2 years, got nothing in return, and he said we would do so again if there would be advantages to the country. But we insist that we won't reward bad behavior by talking with regimes like Iran. We'll work to throw them over.
And speaking of that, Andrew Coburn and Counterpunch and Seymour Hersh in the New Yorker magazine have disclosed hundreds of millions of dollars allocated by the Democrats in the House and the Senate for Bush to spend on covert activity inside Iran. Do you have any information about that?
I only have what Cy Hersh reported. It's what's called a presidential finding. For covert action to take place, the president must make what's called a finding, that is to approve it. Then certain select members of the Congress are informed of the covert action. It wasn't the initiative of the Congress. It was, if the allegations are true, it was an initiative of the Bush administration, completely consistent with its past positions on the overthrow of the regime.
Well, although for them to say, gee, all we did was give him the money, we didn't know he was going to use it supporting terrorist groups inside Iran, is kind of, you know, they are the U.S. Senate after all, aren't they?
Oh, no, they would, if this in fact is the case, the procedure is that any covert action before it is implemented, there must be notification of certain key members in the Congress. Now, whether all of the key members in the Congress have to agree with it or not, or whether any vote is taken, I doubt. It's that they must be informed ahead of time. So whoever has been informed, presumably the ranking member and the chairman of the Intelligence Committee at a minimum, would probably have to concur in some way or another with it, but they clearly are precluded from going public with that information.
Mm-hmm. And now that seems like the kind of thing that's probably most likely to start a conflict. After all, they are allies of the same people that we're propping up in Iraq, the Dawah Party and Supreme Islamic Council type, so there's no real reason to think we'd have a serious border dispute in Iraq. But if we're supporting Jandullah and Mujahideen al-Khalq terrorists, PJAK terrorists, and others inside Iran, that's the kind of thing that could get a response that then the war party here could call them starting the war against us.
Well, and there is pretty strong evidence that we have been cooperating with both of those organizations that you mentioned before. This sounds like a step up if what Cy Hersh says is correct. This would be a broader gauged kind of operation than the previous. See, we've even got, there's something called the Iran Slush Fund that has been appropriated over the last 2 or 3 years to promote democracy in Iran, and that's open. There's nothing covert about that. And that's been about $60 million. The people promoting democracy within Iran have asked the administration and the Congress to cut it off because clearly it's not transparent. So the authorities in Iran don't know who the recipients are of the money that we've appropriated to promote democracy within their country. So they crack down across the board and they limit the political space for precisely the kind of dialogue and promotion of democracy that we're trying to encourage.
Well, now, what exactly do you think is going on there? On one hand, I could see that the policymakers in the White House are just fools and cannot judge the consequences of their actions and how the people they are trying to help only end up hurt by the help that they're offered. On the other hand, it seems like there's been a policy all along to try to marginalize the moderates as much as possible so that we have the worst guys to point our fingers at.
Well, I think what you're dealing with is an ideological mindset, the same kind of preconceptions that caused us to believe that a Western-style democracy in a free market economy would immediately emerge in Iraq from the overthrow of the regime, and that this would be contagious in the region. And if it didn't happen spontaneously in other countries, we'd help it along with military force. It's people who have that preconceived notion. And in the case of Iran, the preconceived notion is that the young people in Iran are right on the edge of rebellion and are going to overthrow the clerics because they don't like living in that kind of regime. And what these advocates we have don't understand is that when you put pressure on a regime, you cause the people in that country to come together defensively against external imposition. Most people in this country don't remember that we overthrew Mohammad Mossadegh, elected in 1951, and put the Shah back in power and helped him establish SAVAK, which was a highly repressive secret police. But every Iranian remembers that, and they are understandably very suspicious when you have a president that openly says to the people, you deserve a better government than this. My message to you is that you ought to change the government. And then we take actions that signal precisely that that is our objective. And you can't take an ideologue and expect him to change his mind just because the people in Iran that you're trying to influence say, look, what you're doing is counterproductive. You can't impose democracy on us externally. It's got to grow from within. They won't pay any attention to that any more than they paid attention to all the warnings that came from the State Department, the CIA, even within the Defense Department itself, that the likely outcome of an invasion in Iraq would be an insurgency. They paid no attention.
Yeah, they just didn't believe it at all, huh? They didn't even hear it.
They didn't even listen to it because it was contrary to their preconceived notion.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so tell me this. I guess, you know, we're all a bunch of amateur criminologists out here trying to interpret what we see going on in the Imperial Court up there in D.C. When Lieutenant General Guard, yourself, when you speak out on matters such as this, are we to interpret that you're speaking for the brass friends that you still see on weekends inside the Pentagon who are deeply concerned about this, or you're just speaking for yourself and Lawrence Korb here?
Well, I'm speaking for myself, and hopefully I haven't done any violence to Larry Korb's views. He's very knowledgeable. And Jack Shanahan, there are several retired officers who share these views. People who are on active duty simply are not in a position to speak out whatever their personal views. In my own case, I've been retired from the Army for quite some time. I don't know active duty officers today.
Well, when you see Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, going to Israel, shuttle diplomacy by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and then speaking to reporters and warning of, I forget his exact new speak, but basically grave consequences in the event of war with Iran. Is that signal serious infighting in the administration where somebody like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs feels it's necessary, perhaps, that he needs to go public and say these things in front of cameras and microphones?
Well, he's in a very, very delicate position. He obviously has to support the decisions of the commander-in-chief. So he can take some of the commander-in-chief's comments, such as, we prefer to solve this diplomatically, and stretch it a little. I mean, he has clearly signaled that we don't need another war on top of the two we have. But he really is walking a fine line. You remember what happened to Fox Fallon, the commander of Central Command, when I forget the publication that came out with the fact that he was standing against the administration's proclivities to attack Iran and then was forced to retire.
Yeah, I forget if it was Esquire.
Esquire, or yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
So, you see, if you go a little too far, you then will be asked to leave or you will offer to leave, depending on how it works. So you have to be careful.
And now in that Seymour Hersh article we talked about earlier, he references a lunch between some Democratic senators and the Secretary of Defense. And Gates reportedly, although he later denied it, rang true anyway, and there were multiple sources apparently for Hersh, who said that he warned that if America attacked Iran, it's sort of buried in the subtext, this really would start a war of civilizations. This really would start a generational conflict like the one that they pretend is real in the battle against Al-Qaeda.
Well, I think Gates, and here again, he's walking a chalk line. But he even said, if you'll recall, just this past May, in the middle of the month, that, you know, we may have missed some earlier opportunities for dialogue with Iran. I guess the historians would have to take a look at that. But he went on to say that we must figure out a way to develop some leverage and then sit down and talk to them. He said that. And he said if there's going to be a discussion, they need to get something out of it, too. So I think he's a voice of reason in the administration, as best I can tell, as an observer barely cleared for rumor, never mind classified information.
Well, you know, I think it was the New York Times reporting on this upcoming meeting in Geneva this Saturday between State Department weenie William Burns and the Iranian nuclear negotiator guy, whatever his name is. And I think it was in their reporting that they said there was a meeting Monday in the White House, and that I forget who all, Hadley, the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State, and the Vice President Dick Cheney were all there. I forgot if they mentioned Gates or not, but apparently, at least according to the New York Times reporting, which I don't know whether you want to give or take that, Dick Cheney was in the room and lost the argument to Condoleezza Rice on whether we were going to have this meeting this Saturday or not, It wasn't like she snuck up on Cheney and went around him and got this done. Apparently, he was in the room and lost the fight in front of the president.
That sounds to me to be quite reasonable. Cheney, you almost never see a picture of the president meeting on some important issue without Vice President Cheney right on his elbow. But I think this is something of a breakthrough in that we have outsourced all the negotiations with Iran. We've refused to talk with them. As Condoleezza Rice used to say, they know what they need to do. All they have to do is stop enriching uranium, and I'll meet with them. But now I think they finally have realized that, look, we made some progress in Korea when we said we'd never talk to them until they did all the things ahead of time. We said that the Koreans had to do a complete, irreversible, verifiable cessation of their nuclear program before we talked to them. But somewhere a year or two ago, the president was persuaded that, you know, maybe other nations aren't going to do ahead of time everything we want them to do, and then we would finally condescend to talk to them with no commitments on our part. That maybe diplomacy has something to do with talking with a nation with whom you have fundamental disagreements, looking for a solution that benefits both sides. Dictating the outcome prior to commencing the negotiations is not the road to progress. The administration reversed itself on Korea, much to the distress of John Bolton, as you know, and now at least they're sending the number three in the State Department, admittedly only as an observer. He does not have license to negotiate, but this is the first time that we will have had a representative present when the Europeans have been negotiating with the Iranians, presumably on our behalf. But The Iranians don't feel threatened by the Europeans. They want to talk to us. And they've made that abundantly clear. And the overtures have continued from the very, very open and expansive offer of May 2003 right up to offers made this year.
Mm-hmm. And now, are you hopeful or confident at all that Bush really means it, that this is some sort of turnaround and, you know, that war can be avoided?
I don't think this is very much of a turnaround, except in this case, the package that we've offered as a basis for negotiations, and we are among the offering powers as we were not until 2006, include that nations will refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state. Now, that is a breakthrough because it's the first time that we've made an offer to Iran similar to what we did that broke the logjam in Korea. And then it's symbolic, but importantly symbolic, that the number three in the State Department will be in the delegation that meets with the Iranians.
All right. Well, we'll cross our fingers and hope that the indications that we're headed toward a peaceful resolution are going to trump all the indications that we're headed toward a violent action here. We'll hope that works out. I want to thank you very much for your time today. Everybody, retired U.S. Army Lieutenant General Robert Gard. He's the chairman of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, former president of National Defense University. The website is armscontrolcenter.org. Really appreciate your time on the show today.
Thank you very much.